Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have a great show for you this week. There's a new Ranger. More importantly, perhaps there's a new Ranger Raptor. We're going to talk about that with the man who wrote it up. That's Associate Editor Byron Hurd. Plus get to a bunch of other things, including the Hyundai Envision 74 concept. Rumors are that may go to production. I happen to quite think that they should do that. And a bunch of other news, some things coming and going, as well as what we've been driving. I spent some time in a very notable 5-liter V8. That's the IS500, which, let me tell you, that was a lot of fun. And Byron has been driving a couple of Alfa Romeos, most significantly the new Tonale. So let's jump right into it. Welcome aboard, Byron. How's it going?
Hey, pretty good. Fresh off a trip to Italy, which is, you know, always fun. The post-trip crud that I came down with, maybe not so exciting, but I feel confident I'll be able to push all the way through this, so feeling all right.
Sounds good. Like I was saying, allergies have been hitting me pretty hard, but I have three drinks for this podcast: a coffee, a tangerine LaCroix, and a very tall glass of water. So there will be a time limit here, because you can't really have three drinks and talk forever, if you will. Three drink Wednesday. That's not a bad way to do it. Last week was three drink Wednesday, but they were three of the same kind. It was three gin and tonics. So, but not for the podcast. This was after hours. Right. So, but yeah, people want to hear about the Ranger. You wrote this up. You went to a briefing. I have some thoughts, but you did sort of the initial round of reporting. So some highlights. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there are really no surprises here. I mean, we knew that the global Raptor power numbers were going to be kind of on the soft side compared to what we'd get here. And I mean, it's really not a surprise that they didn't bust out and go like above and beyond where the Raptor for Bronco power output is. So they, you know, they're playing in kind of the same space, but the Bronco still has a, you know, as an icon, as Ford's calling them, gets a little more power, but still 405 horses for a midsize truck isn't bad. And, you know, really everything that we already liked about the Ranger, the size, the capability really hasn't changed. The addition of Raptor is huge, but, you know, just looking at the kind of core truck, if you still just wanted the kind of inexpensive four-cylinder all-wheel or four-wheel drive, that formula hasn't really changed. The only option now that it really changes anything going on with the base truck is the availability of that new kind of mid-range V6, which is interesting because mid-sized trucks really haven't been a place where you get a lot of engine options. So apart from Gladiator, which was kind of, you know, throwing a wrench in convention, this is kind of nice. It's interesting to see this space that was probably considered dead maybe about a decade ago is really kind of taking off again. And granted, the trucks have gotten bigger, which has probably helped. And especially with bigger trucks getting even more expensive, it's, you know, creating more space for things like the Ranger and GM's equivalents and the Gladiator, which has had really kind of better sales over the past couple of years than it deserved, just because, you know, the pandemic was forcing people to buy whatever they could get. And that worked out well for Jeep, which got to sell a lot more pickups than they were planning on. So, you know, good for them. But this is definitely an expanding and very interesting space. And the Ranger looks like it'll, you know, keep on doing what we already appreciate about it. And the Raptor is going to make it a lot more fun. Yeah. So what I'm really interested to see is which trims end up getting the V6, the mid-range V6 is an option, and how those end up pricing out, because it's not going to be the most capable way to spec the truck. Like, if you want the max towing capability and the max payload, you actually want the four-cylinder engine, because the weight of the V6 actually takes away from both. But it's going to give you a little extra grunt, you know, the people who maybe want to tow things more frequently that are kind of heavy, but not quite reaching the max, but just appreciate the extra grunt that you get from the V6. Probably going to want that. And honestly, just, you know, make the truck just a little bit more interesting and engaging to drive too. Might get to see that in, you know, like a Tremor variant, something like that, where, you know, they actually put that power to good use. So it'll be interesting to see how this kind of develops over the next year.
Yeah. It's interesting because when you look, the actual Ranger itself globally debuted almost 2 years ago at this point, and even the Raptor came out. But what we're getting, as one would expect, is a bit more interesting than the rest of the world. So that's good. It's definitely a powerful version. And the Raptor, you know, I noticed this in your writing and looking at some of the, like, just the pricing, I think it's a decent deal. Like, if you want that sort of Raptor vibe and the midsize truck is your segment, like, you can get a lot of power. It's cheaper than the Bronco Raptor and obviously the F-150 Raptor. So I think it's kind of the value way, if you will, to get into the Raptor nameplate.
Yeah, and really, I mean, if you're looking at, you know, other things kind of in that same price segment, if you're looking at like GM has the Colorado Canyon Twins, which both have their, you know, kind of off-road upfit equivalents now. Those play nicely with like the Gladiator Rubicon and the Gladiator Mojave, but the Raptor is just so different from any of them because it's all about, you know, high speed and like, you know, going over nasty terrain, but at a high pace versus, you know, the crawling basically that you're going to be doing in a ZR2 or AT4X or a Gladiator Rubicon. So it's interesting that we've got a bunch of choices and Ford is kind of deliberately choosing not to play in the exact same space as everybody else, which, I mean, that's kind of been F-150's thing. So it's not surprising that it's also Ranger's thing. But, you know, if you look at kind of the nitty gritty capability, I mean, the Raptor still gets locking front and rear differentials, which is nice because, you know, that's good if you actually do want to go crawling. And it does have a 2-speed transfer case. So you can do low range crawling in a Ranger Raptor. There's nothing stopping you. It's just maybe not going to be the best tool for the job, but it's gonna be interesting to see how that exactly shakes out.
Yeah, I think you know, just from like a cosmetic standpoint, I think they kind of brought it into this, you know, the 2020s, if you will, and I think they needed to do that. The last truck, which I personally liked, I think I liked it a little bit more than the market and my fellow like peers ended up liking it. You know, the truck got old really quick. Deservedly so, because it was an old truck when it came here. There was that sort of novelty of, hey, the Ranger's back, and hey, here's Ford's take on the midsize segment. But it was, you know, it'd been sold overseas for years. So a lot of times, you know, reviewers would get into it and they're like, oh, wow, this is kind of an old truck. It looks and feels that way, which, again, I kind of like that. It reminded me almost like of like a Land Cruiser or a 4Runner feel, but... And I think you could get away with it sort of in a truck, especially in the midsize truck segment, but there was no getting around it. It was kind of dated. So I'll be very interested to see like how the interior actually looks and feels, you know, other than pictures, it's kind of tough to tell here. Did they say anything about the actual like platform? I just trying to read around. I wasn't quite able to extrapolate that. What's the story there?
So essentially, this is like a further evolution of what Bronco already did for the Global Ranger platform. So this kind of incorporates what they've learned from both the, I'm not going to say the original truck, but the older truck and everything they learned while doing Bronco. Okay. So you get, there's a reinforced frame for the Raptor, especially. They took a bunch from Bronco Raptor, effectively just kind of ported it over. But I mean, in terms of, you know, it being like a fundamental, like reimagining of the way a pickup truck is built. No, the yeah. platform is, you know, the same basic architecture is still there.
Got it.
And that's actually, you know, noteworthy in that a lot of trucks are now transitioning to platforms that might look for like electrification options and things like that, which Ford is doing that in Lightning up in the full size space. And it's doing that to a degree with Maverick in its, you know, unibody space, if, you know, for lack of a better term. But there's not a whole lot coming from them in terms of midsize. And, you know, we've heard before like rumors of a hybridized Bronco. So there's, you know, there's some hypothetical possibility there, especially because the transmissions that they're using in all of these cars are the same ones that are used in their rear-wheel drive hybrids. So theoretically, you know, component-wise, they're in a position to do it. But, you know, we haven't heard anything along those lines quite yet. And at this point, Ranger's probably too new for them to be ready to pivot on that at this, you know, you've got Ford's had some trouble with launches over the last few years, we'll say, you know, like, you know.
It's putting it mildly, It's putting it mildly.
Yeah, in all kindness, it's been tumultuous, right? So I think at this point, they would like to just get the launch of the truck out of the way. And then if they've got anything up their sleeve, you know, give it a little time to bake.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think this is, you know, kind of like at a high level, this is going to be a very interesting year for products. And maybe I say that every year, but there's a lot of things I'm really interested in getting into, like, that are either just launched, just revealed, but they're things that we're going to get probably significant seat time in this year. You know, whether it's like the Prius making its way into the fleet, the Hyundai Ioniq 6, this is right up there. I think this is going to be a really, you know, interesting, you know, take on the segment. It's obviously very Ford, and that's going to work. I tend to think this isn't going to draw a lot of new buyers into Ford. That's what the Maverick is for, and maybe that's what the Lightning is for. This is essentially like replacing something that is part of their strategy, but I'll be curious to see like what they do after this too. Not to already put this thing out to pasture, but I mean, this is a very like of the moment, even of the last like moment, such as it is, vehicle product. It's there's nothing groundbreaking here. So yeah, but I'm really excited to drive it. Like I said, I like the old one. I liked its kind of, I almost liked the dated charm of it. Like that kind of hit with me. So I'll be really interested to see what some of these upgrades do for it.
Well, and we've also got, you know, the Tacoma coming along here relatively soon. So pretty soon, you know, virtually everything you can buy in this space is going to be new or pretty close to it, because, you know, the GMs are already here or arriving, and Ford's arriving, and with Toyota not far behind. I mean, that's it. The only thing that's truly old by any measure is now Gladiator, and even that is only just a few years old. So, and especially since it was a clean sheet design, I mean, you really can't get much fresher than that. So that's, it's going to be really interesting, especially if we start to see some electrical interplay in some of these. And we already know that Jeep has the capability to do 4xe on the Gladiator if it wants to. Yeah. So it's just a matter of, I think, when at this point, not if. And I think everybody in this space is just kind of waiting to see who goes first, you know, and we see that especially in, you know, with the quote unquote domestics, the inclination to kind of hang back and then leapfrog after somebody kind of, you know, puts themselves out there for the first time. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that in the mid-size space, excuse me. But yeah, it's going to be fun. And these are, you know, trucks that feel a little more, you know, accessible and attainable, and are probably more size appropriate to the average truck owner for especially urban areas. And you know, that's an area where everyone wants to play. So
it's going to be a, you know, I think a very competitive year in the midsize truck segment. You know, we've already seen the Canyon and the Colorado, the latest versions of those. We know the next gen Tacoma is coming up. It's like it's 2014 all over again, if you will, as far as like people getting back into the segment. And for me, this is really the area, if I were looking to get a truck, I would probably look at this one. I, frankly, the Maverick does enough for literally probably 60 to 70% of people who think they need a truck. Then there's like the people who really do need the, like the work truck. And for them, it's like, you know, the full size will do it. And then you get this in between area. And I just, to me, it's where maybe like the emotion meets the metrics. And like, this is just a little truckier than like a metric. Or then like a Maverick, if you will. So, you know, we'll see. It's the I almost called it the Mustang. The Ranger has always had an emotional element to it. So I'm excited to kind of see how those intangibles feel, you know, like that that off-road pack that the current generation has, the FX4 just suspension. That's just, it's fun. So it'd be interesting to see if they can, and I think they will. I anticipate they will maintain that just kind of like fun enthusiast truck vibe here. So that's the Ranger. Check it out. We have a lot of pictures. There's some video. It's already up on the site, of course. Get in the comments. Let us know what you think. So, all right. Now we're going to run through a few other news items here. Rear wheel drive is back in the Volvo lineup. You know, it's been a while, I believe since the 90s, since they've last had one. Yep, the 90s. It's just a different kind of feel for them. You know, I think it's, they've been front wheel drive, sometimes all wheel drive. You haven't thought of rear wheels being a calling card for Volvo. And it does give, you know, a little bit of that performance vibe, which I think is cool. And I mean, we'll just, again, another vehicle that I'm interested in trying. We'll see. I mean, what do you think? Part of me doesn't think Volvo needs to do this, but given the electrification of running gear, they can. So they are. So I don't know. Do you think this is a difference maker, or is this inside baseball?
I mean, I don't know about difference maker, but it is just kind of a nice illustration of the versatility you get from electrification, at least. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we'd say, oh, well, we're never going to get rear-wheel drive cars from this manufacturer again, because once they switched to front-wheel drive and, you know, started chasing efficiency, well, there was no incentive whatsoever for them to go back. And now that doesn't really apply so much anymore, it's kind of nice to see that, you know, some automakers are actually trying to be flexible with what they offer. And I don't know that it's necessarily a need for Volvo. I agree with you there. Like, they, you know, probably could have gone by without just as easily and just made everything front-wheel drive instead of rear. But I like that they didn't. So it's a it's a yes vote from me, even if it's not necessarily something that, you know, the whole world might actually want.
Okay, so we're also getting news this week about the Mercedes CLS retiring, if you will, in 2023. And, you know, it marks sort of the end of an era, if you will, for kind of the swoopy coupe-styled sedans. You know, they use the CLS. They began to use that a little more widely. But to me, this was almost like an A7, S7 fighter back when that was really at the, you know, like a calling card for Audi. So, I mean, for one thing, I will say this. I think Mercedes has too many models. They're frankly a little confusing unless you're a really hardcore Mercedes buyer or fan. This is one that they're covering this space with some of the AMGs and even some of the electrics, which are like kind of swoopy coupe things. So I think it's entirely reasonable for them to nuke this one. But I mean, what do you think? Even though I've always liked the designs.
I kind of hate what this car did for the idea of a coupe. I think I'll forever resent it just on that basis alone, whether it was good or bad. And honestly, it was, you know, more good than bad. But I'll forever hold it against that this particular car that we have to fight over the definition of a coupe and a sedan. But it is, I mean, certainly it was significant. It has been for the last, you know, 15 years of design, especially for luxury coupes. So, you know, its impact is undeniable, but I'm not particularly sad to see it go personally.
Others did this segment better too. Like I said, Audi for one, you know, again, they, even Mercedes and their sort of like closing press statement, if you will, like said that they could cover this segment with other things, you know, either slightly different price points, but you know, I can see why they're letting this thing go. Plus sedans, you know, full stop. You don't need a lot of flavors of sedans right now. And Mercedes already has plenty of them at all different levels.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the Hyundai Envision 74. Rumors earlier this week were that it was going to be produced. You look super excited. I think you're in favor.
Yes, I love this thing. Put it together, call it the pony, put it in a showroom. Mm-hmm. Let's get this thing going. I'm super on board for this, 100%.
All right, I love it. I mean, I literally feel the same way. I had a column idea for this week on something entirely different, something about like V8s or something. Wrote a few sentences, then I read Ronan Glahn, who's one of our, you know, main news guys, had the story. And I was like, you know what, I kind of want to riff on this. I wrote down, started writing. And 550 some words later, I had a column. So that's kind of where I landed. I think they should do it too. If you look at like the headline in my piece, I'm basically telling them like, pony up, do it. Like you get, if they don't have the business case, I made one for them. Like cut out all that hydrogen BS. You're not going to do that. You got the powertrain with the Ioniq 5 and 6. And oh, by the way, no, most people did not know the pony and it's amazing. Like, Jujaro backstory exists. A lot of them do now. Suddenly you've got this deep cut, like get in there. You know, it's like, there's a lot of companies that should do sports cars that don't. Hey, Hyundai, you can right now go do it.
Yeah. 100% agreed. I've loved this. I mean, we spent probably just 20 minutes standing around this thing in LA, even though it wasn't technically new by the time we got a chance to see it. And, you know, Hyundai actually had the Ioniq 6 there to show us in LA. And they're like, hey, look at this. And we're like, nah, we're gonna be over here with the Vision concept. Thank you and goodbye. So, and it's not even like the Ioniq 6 is boring. It's just that, you know, next to this thing, it's really hard to compete. It's a monster. I love it.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think at first when we first, like the other thing is, like I said, is a lot of people don't know about the backstory here. So when I first saw the Ioniq 5, I was like, well, all right, this is kind of weird. This is kind of weird, even just like for Hyundai random design. But then it's like, oh, wait, they've done this. You know, like, you know, Jujaro has done some designs with them. Like, you know, I wrote this in my column. Not many people have worked with that design house. I mean, they have. So it's like you've kind of got this like great deep cut on the shelf. Go ahead and use it. You know, we'll see. And I think they could go in a couple different ways. Like at first I almost kind of phrased it as like a sports car, Nissan Z, Supra, even like a pony car, you know, Detroit name kind of in there. Cause I mean, ostensibly, I think that's where Hyundai would probably naturally want to compete. But you could look at it the other way and make it like something low volume and really high performance, high price, which at least that's kind of how the concept, the newer one, looks. So I think it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out. It may not be as imminent as like it seemed, if you will. You know, I haven't received any invites to Pony Day, as you know, one of the reports said. But I think they should do this. I think it's a good move for them. And you know, Hyundai Motor Co. has taken some risks, and each of the brands has gone after something. And I think this is a good one for Hyundai to kind of pursue.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, we look at what Genesis has done with their, you know, compact sporty platform. Like there's potential there. And I mean, that was the Genesis Coupe mm-hmm. at one time. So it's not like there's no precedent whatsoever for this, especially in a 2+2 kind of setup, which is really what this would have to be. I mean, you don't necessarily see it in pictures, but in person, it is quite large because it is as big as that big, the X concept that Genesis presented, because they're the same effective platform. So like the concept is big. And I mean, the production version doesn't have to be, but it certainly has the presence if that's the direction they want to go with it.
It seems like Hyundai has been dropping some kind of hints about this too. Like the original 1974 concept, hence 74, was actually destroyed, I think, sometime in the 70s. And they're gonna rebuild it with the design house. I think it's called GFG now, which is essentially Jujaro. They're gonna rebuild that. They put like an electric motor and one of the subsequent like pony cars, which is like more of like a hatchback that ran in like the 70s up into like the early 90s. So like they've been kind of acting like, hey guys, like kind of look over here, we might do something. So
yeah,
you know, I don't know. I think, you know, let's hope there's, you know, some fire where there's certainly some smoke and it's not a smoke screen. So yeah. All right, so here's some real life stuff, if you will, the actual goods, no smoke screens. This is the Porsche. This is the 718 Spyder RS. Pretty wild looking. You know, I tend to like these, you know, just this. I like the 718. It's the thing that I think has always been very fun to drive. I'm one of those people who's like kind of on the fence, like 911, 718, Boxster, Cayman. For me, it's a little tougher call than I think it is for some people, but yeah, this is just like, you know, the really sharp tip of the spear, if you will. 3.2 seconds to 60, kind of wild looks. You get a watch with it. What do you think?
Yeah, I love this thing. I mean, they're super cool. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing that's going to be gobbled up by collectors and never see the light of day because, you know, yeah, these things are just... they're cars that are meant to be appreciated by people, and people never really get to see them, which is sad. So I love what it is. I just, you know, more in the days when special cars actually circulated instead of just living in people's Instagram galleries. So yeah, hopefully we'll see a few of these actually on the street. I mean, I personally, looking at the 2718s, for me it would be the Cayman, just because I would want the take it to the track all the time kind of attitude of that. And would gleefully do that if I could afford to drop $250,000 on one of these things after markup. But I would certainly not be soured if I learned that either one of them is going to be in my driveway.
It's almost 500 horsepower, 493 to be exact. It's like the GT4 goodies and a bunch of other stuff mixed in there to make this just a very intense 718. Almost 60 pounds lighter than just a typical Spyder convertible, if you will. Crazy huge wheels. It's a lot, let me put it that way. But you know, it's pretty wild. And then the watch itself, I think, is $8,000. So you know, when I think of Porsche designed watches, I think of the one that Tom Cruise wore in Top Gun. I think both Top Guns, different watch than this, obviously, but kind of a cool chronograph, you know. I mean, if you're going to spend the money to get the car, you might as well get the watch, right?
Yeah, right. Well, that way you can sell them both in, you know, 25 years and have a package deal.
Exactly. All right. So let's talk about what we've been driving. You went to Italy. Why don't you go first? I didn't go to Italy with the car I was driving. So let's hear about what's up with Alfa.
So yeah, they had us over to Milan to drive the new Tonale, and it was really interesting. I was on the drive for the Dodge Hornet, which was in North Carolina. It's a very different experience, but very similar cars. And honestly, you know, in terms of the actual routes we went to drive on, were very similar in the way they were laid out. Just the visuals were very different. We'll put it that way. But it really is interesting to kind of forget the Hornet, because that's going to be hard, I think, for really more for us than for like general consumers to like set aside the Hornet when thinking about the Tonale, because really the Hornet is not watered down all that much. The Tonale comes only in the Veloce trim hiller, so you only get the plug-in hybrid. You don't have a like a lower power output or anything like that. There's no ICE engine only version. It's just the plug-in. So you get 285 horsepower, 347 pound-feet of torque. It's, you know, big bulky system. It's a 4,200-ish pound crossover, but it's a little small. So yeah, it's kind of heavy, a little bit on the smaller side for practicality, but it is actually genuinely fun to drive, which is a standout in this segment, because really the competitors to it here are going to be like your Lexus NH 450 Plus hybrid, another plug-in, or the Lincoln Corsair. And the Corsair, I mean, especially, you look at it, it's not meant to be like an enthusiast corner carving machine. It's a luxury car first. The plug-in, I mean, sure, makes it real grunty, like it's got plenty of power off the line, but it's not a performance vehicle first. It is a hybrid. It is a luxury car. It is not pretending to be an enthusiast fun vehicle. The Lexus kind of leans that way because they have the F-Sport package, so you can get like, you know, the sharper handling and the adjustable steering. It's, you know, a little more kind of enthusiast oriented, but I would say the Lexus looks are a little polarizing. It's, you know, you have to kind of, you know, and I'm not going to say a face only a mother could love, but it's, you know, not traditionally pretty. The Alpha, I think, just looks quite good. It drives quite nicely, and it's priced quite aggressively if you're going to lease it, because that's the one way you can still take advantage of plug-in hybrids that are not built in the United States under the new Inflation Reduction Act rules. So you can get $7,500 off this thing when you lease it, which starts at about $45,000. So now you're talking about, you know, mid-high 30s. You're getting into a car with no options that's well under the average transaction price of a new car sold in the U.S. So there's that. It's an Alfa Romeo. It's got 285 horsepower. It's quite, like, surprisingly fun to throw around corners. It actually, you know, does play quite nicely. And Alfa really wants to sell them. So there's going to be, I'm not going to come out and say, oh, they're going to do incentives, but Alfa is going to push these hard. There's going to be, you know, streaming TV advertising and things like that, which we haven't seen on Alfa Romeos in years. So the idea of them kind of, you know, pushing hard for a more mainstream market with this car that actually is kind of more mainstream oriented makes a lot more sense. It's front wheel drive based, not rear wheel drive based. It's, you know, not meant to be a Stelvio competitor or alternative, really. It's meant to appeal to people who might not necessarily choose Alfa Romeo because they're not exposed to it, because they're not enthusiasts, because they're not chasing performance figures. So that's who this car is meant for. But it has like just the kind of knock-on effect of introducing a relatively fun car to a segment that doesn't really have any. So it's a lot of fun to drive. Yeah, the Hornet exists and it's cheaper, but the looks, I think, favor the Alpha because it was an Alpha first, and you can really tell. I mean, badge engineering kind of died in this country 10, 15 years ago, and it's maybe back a little bit now. You know, we see it in trucks, but we don't usually see it in, like, you know, compacts and crossovers the way we're doing with this one. You know, even GM does a really good job differentiating all their stuff. But if you look at a Hornet next to a Tonale, it is the same vehicle with some very minor tweaks, especially inside. It's literally just the top third of the dash. You lift it off of the Dodge, you put the Italian version back on, and you're there. It is, you know, the differentiation is definitely not significant. And I think that was really pull from FCA's, you know, division, the lingering FCA-ness underneath the Stellantis North America, where they needed a car and they had the dealer network to say, hey, look, we're losing the Dodge Challenger. We're losing the Dodge Charger. Our two most affordable cars are gone. We have nothing. We need a car now. And Hornet filled that role perfectly. Compact crossover in a segment that wants them badly in a country that gobbles them up. Perfect. And it came kind of at Alfa Romeo's expense. So they built this nice kind of elegant alternative to an enthusiast sedan, since we don't really do those at the cheap end anymore. And they're like, hey, here it is. And Dodge said, thanks, erased all the Alfa Romeo badges and stuck theirs on it. And they were out the door. So it works as it's kind of a disservice to Alfa, but it doesn't make the Tonale any worse. So you know, if you're looking at this segment, you think, okay, I want a plugin, because you have to for this to make a ton of sense. You want a plugin, you want a luxury name, but you don't want, you know, kind of the more boring alternatives that are out there. It's right there. It's for you. It's cheap, comparably. So it's a very compelling package. It is genuinely a lot of fun to drive. And it'll be interesting to see if this actually gets the kind of mainstream pickup that Alpha is hoping for, because, you know, the Giulia Quadrifoglio crowd is not who this car is meant for. And they would rather get, you know, 15 people to buy Tenalis than, you know, just one enthusiast alternative at this point, because they need to grow their sales base. Like, they need customers and they just don't have them. And, you know, the pandemic was great for profitability across the entire industry, but Alpha was still doing incentives for most of it, even when others didn't have to. So it's a weird space they're in, but if they can capitalize on it, it could be huge for them.
Seems like a little bit of desperation here on like everyone's part here. Dodge, Alfa Romeo, Stellantis. You know, in a vacuum, I again, here's yet another vehicle I'm excited to spend some more time in this year and drive. It sounds pretty good. I think, you know, the other side is like, well, there's a Dodge with a huge amount of it also rolling around, which is, you know, never good. The argument to that is that, well, look pretty closely at your Lexus and you can see a lot of Toyota in there. Same with Acura and Honda and, you know, some of the other luxury brands as well, especially more like the premium versus the mainstream, you know, that type of thing. So, there's a couple of few different ways to look at it. The other thing too, is you could argue outside of Metro Detroit, where people with it's probably still the Chrysler discount, would be actually cross shopping Tenales and Hornets. You're not going to get like Alfa Romeo and Dodge customers overlapping. So they're never going to know the difference is, you know, another way to look at it. I don't know if that's kind of fatalistic, but you know, they're probably never going to know how similar they are in many ways. But it, you know, based on like what you said and just my own reading, I think there's a lot to like here. And, you know, Alpha has always been pretty good at design, you know, and making something that's going to make you turn your head and go, hey, what's that? So this will be interesting. It is a pretty important vehicle for them, though. They need to get this right, get a little bit more volume, you know, at least get people to understand that, hey, they offer a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid at that. I don't think of Alpha when I think of plug-in hybrids, so that's something. I mean, this is going to be an interesting one. Let's put it that way. I think, you know, and it's like you said, for Dodge, they're making out great here. Alpha, I can kind of see, because the Dodge reveal and the Dodge Drive were a couple months ago. So now it's kind of like, hey, here's the Alpha. And, you know, it's a little bit of a sense of deja vu. So.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for everybody, really, because the narrative would have made a lot more sense if the Alpha had already been introduced and made, you know, widely available in the US before the Dodge came along. Because then you could say, oh, well, there I see the Alpha in the Dodge. But because the Dodge showed up first, it kind of it screws up the script. Because when you look at the inside of the Hornet, it looks very much like an Alpha. Like, it doesn't, you know, if you're used to Dodge's contemporary design, like, you don't get into a Durango, get out of it and look at the Hornet and go, oh yeah, that's obviously from the same manufacturer. Right. You know, like, the everything in the domestic, you know, quote unquote domestic stuff is big and chunky and, like, you know, just knocked out of a piece of granite or something like that.
Right.
And all the Alpha influence in Hornet makes it all very kind of thin and delicate, you know, like it's that lithe European kind of feel to everything rather than the chunky, hard worn American feel. So it's the Hornet that is out of place. It's not the Alpha. And it just kind of unfortunately bites Alpha instead of Dodge, just, you know, by virtue of the way everything went down. So, like you said, it's just not a comparison that's going to be made outside of, you know, those who are in the know and actually, you know, want to bargain hunt effectively a Tenali, because that's what you're doing by buying a Hornet. So, you know, it's also like, and it needs to be said too, the Hornet is the great option if you don't want the plug-in. I mean, there's no reason to spring for the Alpha unless you absolutely want the plug-in. There's, you know, you'd be crazy to spend the extra money just to get the badge. So in that case, yeah, absolutely, the Hornet makes a ton of sense. But once you get to the Hornet RT, you actually start to kind of play in the same price range as an entry level Tenali. So, and the price spread on them is not significant. It starts at about 45 and caps off at under 50. So it's not like there's a huge price difference from the bottom to the top of Tenali lineup. And the Hornet is knocking on the low end of Tenali at RT pricing anyway. So if you, you know, if you're talking PHEV, if you must have that, then it gets really interesting. If not, then just go with a Hornet and make your life easier. But that's, you know, that's for our audience. That's not so much for general audience who probably isn't going to be shopping that way. And, you know, if we really wanted to get weird, we could throw in the Jeep Compass, which is also on that same platform and the one that looks the most distinct of the three because it has like a completely Jeep interior and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's interesting because if you actually sit back, the Compass now comes with a 200 horsepower version of the 2-liter turbo engine that comes in the Alpha and the Dodge. But it costs the same as the Hornet. So that's kind of the premium look there, right? You get less performance, you get less engine, you get less, you know, of that, but you get the more upscale, quote unquote, Jeep kind of interior experience. So that's the premium angle kind of leaning in there. So like the Alpha kind of combines the best of both. You get all the performance you get in the Dodge, and you get all the upscaleness you get from the Jeep all in one package. If you buy into the idea of that kind of Jeep upscaleness actually being an appropriate upscaleness for Alpha, because the quality like of materials is probably about the same. So it's a long way around to getting there, but it's a weird situation, you know, especially the way everything, the order in which everything was introduced and in which we were able to actually consume it has made a much muddier situation than there might otherwise be.
Well, I mean, it's not actually all that uncommon, too. I mean, what about Acura RDX versus Honda CR-V? You know, yeah. I mean, that's just maybe a very obvious mainstream example, but it's, again, you know, there's many examples of that throughout the industry. You know,
yeah, Honda's a great example, too, because, like, when you go from Honda to Acura styling-wise, it's really, you know, you're getting upgrades in like material quality and stuff like that, but they tend to kind of lean in the same direction. So you mm-hmm. kind of get a very similar aesthetic between the two of them. And, you know, with the Lexus, you know, the NX versus the RAV4 that it's based on, you know, the RAV4 Prime exists. So that's your, you know, your Hornet RT equivalent effectively. But then, you know, you look over at the Lincoln and you have the Escape underneath it. So, I mean, really all three of them do kind of the same thing to some degree or another. It's just that with Dodge and Alpha, the whole situation is much blurrier because Dodge did so little to differentiate the car once it got its hands on it. So it's, you know, it's Dodge's fault, basically.
Hornet bites Alpha. That's the headline, I guess, right? It does seem, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think, you know, when you look back, like, for a really deep cut, you know, the Giulietta ended up being the Dodge Dart and, you know, different price points, smaller cars that were cars. But, you know, that's another example of sort of Alpha and Dodge kind of fighting over the exact same car. Although that one, that was also what that the Giulietta was the Giulietta and Dodge basically ripped it off. And there was even some thought that they might even bring the Giulietta here for a minute, which I drove one here. It was a diesel powered by, geez, whoever made the diesel engine at that point. But that was sort of like one of the, right before Volkswagen kind of went up and spoke with diesel, there was this like push that diesel's actually good for you. So I remember driving the Giulietta and it's a really fun car to drive. It was better than the Dart, let's put it that way. So. All right, let's talk about the ISF. This is the ISF 500. I drove one last week and had a lot of fun. Headline here, the 5-liter V8, 472 horsepower. This had the F Sport, which made it just awesome. This is kind of stealthy. It was gray with black wheels. All the F Sport things like the scuff plates, the door plates, some of the upgraded interior things like the lighting and just, you know, power tilt, all that good stuff too. This one had 19-inch matte black forged wheels, which I thought was just really made this thing look pretty awesome. Let's put it that way. And then my big takeaway, too, was like, man, you know, I'm obviously very excited, very interested about our electric future, but you know, 5 liter V8 is still pretty, it's a really good thing. Let me put it that way. Like, there was no minute in the last week where I was like, man, I wish I'm driving a hybrid. You know, this was a lot of fun to drive this week. It sounded good. And also, you know, sedan, rear wheel drive based sedan, that'll work, you know? So I sense you wouldn't have minded having this car in your driveway either.
No, absolutely not. I was actually a huge fan of the ISF back when it was new. And I drove one of the ones, I think it was around 2011, right after they made some suspension tweaks and made the limited slip rear differential standard, the Torsen, and took that to the track and had an absolute blast with it. I mean, it drove like a pony car, and it was the, you know, perfect kind of bluff to the E90 series M3 with their mm-hmm. V8. And it just, like, it was an absolute dream. And I get that, you know, the platform we have now is effectively just kind of the same thing that's been, you know, mm-hmm. kind of slowly and continuously upgraded over the last 12 years or so. So it certainly can't be bad. I would absolutely love to drive that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, for me, it's like Lexus hasn't really sort of said their end of life plans for V8s or for like sedans or when they're going electric. It's like Toyota is definitely taking longer. Let's put it that way. But another thought I had as I was just kind of rolling around town in this thing is like, you know, if you've ever kind of thought, hey, it's time to get in one of these, well, now is a good time to do it. You know, like if you're looking for like a current generation charger, well, no, you have to do it right now this year. For the IS500, you know, there it's a little more open-ended, but it's still maybe not a bad time. These things aren't going to be around forever. And it's, you know, I mean, 17 city, 25 highway, that's not great, but I mean, it's okay. You know, you could work with that. Let me put it that way. You could drive it. If you got a new one, you could drive it for 20 years. And, you know, as long as there's gas stations, you're going to be okay. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, a V8 rear wheel drive sedan with a lot of F Sport goodies. That was a lot of fun. So, all right. So let's shift things back here. We'll close out the show with your tour of the, what is it called? Museo Storico or something? I'm Italian and I'm butchering it. But this is the Alfa Romeo Museum.
There is something at that museum for literally everybody. I was really surprised. So they have lots of cool things. They have some of the old racing prototypes, like the twin engines. So they have, you know, the ones that have the engine in the front and the back. And then the engines that ran only the right and left wheels. So you had to, like, you know, throttle them independently and all this. It's just wild stuff there. But tons of, you know, regular production stuff, a couple boats, airplanes, things like that. The thing that really stuck out to me, though, being, you know, the kind of weird minutia nerd that I am, is that they had just kind of sitting casually on a shelf in like an archive section, an old Wankel engine just hanging out there. It was so it was a one rotary engine, and so I immediately went to the curator and said, "Hey, what's up with that?" And he kind of clued me in. So I wasn't aware that Alfa had a Wankel program, and they did. They licensed it from NSU in the 60s, and so what Alfa was trying to do was basically make a rotary engine that had the same output as the piston engines that they were offering in the same cars, while using the same transmissions and all the same gear ratios, because they were flat broke. They had no money to spend on redesigning gearboxes to account for the rotary engine. So all the real advantages you get from a rotary engine, like the, you know, the high revs and the constant, you know, high velocity, you just wouldn't get, because they were trying to match it to a gearbox designed for a piston engine. So, you know, it's turning like 5,500 RPM instead of the 8,500 RPM you'd expect for peak power output for a rotary. And so they were able to make it work. They actually got the equivalent power out of the Wankel engines that they did from their piston engines. So that was great, because it was, you know, smaller, lighter, more compact. Emissions were about to become a thing. Fuel economy was starting to matter with, you know, the instability of the world at that point. So like they thought they were onto it, but then as it turned out, they couldn't make it reliable, which I'm sure no one's ever heard anyone say that about a rotary engine before. So the whole program just kind of got scrapped. The prototypes that they built were both crushed. They did keep the powertrain. So they still have literally like the engines, their housings and all that still mated to the transmissions and the rest of the running gear, but the bodies that they put, I believe it was a 750 and a 1300 or something like that, those are now long gone. So that was, it was kind of interesting to me to just see this, you know, engine sitting on a shelf and learn that, you know, there was an entire decade long program to try to bring that to production that ended up just going right in the trash. And some of the things they tried were wild. They tried like cast iron apex seals that were just eating the housings and like all these different things, just trying to make it work. And they never got there. So, you know, it took Mazda's kind of like over the top dedication to the rotary engine to make it last as long as it did. And, you know, little projects like this kind of show that while it made some sense on paper and they were actually able to produce an engine that they, you know, that's, you know, 75, 130 horsepower from a one or two rotor engine, only turning, you know, 4,500 RPM like a typical little, you know, 1.5 liter four cylinder. That's pretty good. The fact that, you know, you can't get even by 1960s Italian standards a reliable lifetime out of it says a lot. So yeah. Interesting little piece of Alfa Romeo history that I learned on that trip.
Man, this podcast, we should call it like Deep Cuts. You know, like almost every segment we've referenced some rather dusty page of history. Yeah, man, that's cool. I also, I had no idea. Like, I like to think I'm a little bit of an automotive historian, but that was one that even I had no idea on. So that's, you know, I'm sure a lot of automakers are like that. They tried something, it didn't work, it didn't get very far, and then it shows up 60 years later in the museum.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you're in Italy, what was the best thing you ate?
Oof, there was some gnocchi appetizer that they gave us like the night we arrived. That, you know, they're literally coming around with the bowl of it, telling people like, hey, if you actually want more, we'll just keep feeding you this. You don't even have to take your main course if you want it. And people were actually taking them up on it. It was just absolutely, it was something that it was sausage and gnocchi. It was made in Sardinia or native to Sardinia. So it was a really cool thing. And I was also drinking a beer that happened to be from Sardinia. So I was very on theme for my first meal in the country. And it turned out to be my favorite meal too. But yeah, that was an absolute winner. It's definitely you have to acclimate to olive oil really quickly over there, or otherwise you may experience a bit of distress, as I learned. But it's one of those things where it's like you can like it all you want, but if you're not used to it all the time, it can get you moving pretty quickly. So okay. You know, especially for a quick trip, things, you know, pro tips, travel trips from Byron at Autoblog. All right.
Watch your olive oil consumption.
Yes,
you know it's very Italian. The oil may be burning, such as it is, so. Got to be careful when you're over across the pond, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you enjoy the Autoblog podcast, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Send us your Spend My Money. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next week.